God, the great puppeteer, kindly allows us to pull our own strings, choosing whom to tug back from disaster's edge. This is the great question, that if we dance wildly across the stage, closer to the flames of rage, will he pull us back or let us smolder in the embers of our self-made blaze? This is a poem by Debbie Hutchison from her collection Legacy of Storms. And in a lot of ways, this poem sort of sums up what Cured by Fire is all about.
Writer Tim McLaurin, he'll be back in just a moment with more about his new book, a novel entitled Cured by Fire. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Tim McLaurin is the author of two previous novels and a memoir. His new book, Cured by Fire, is about the bonds between people, friendship and trust, conflict and adversity. In McLaurin's words, about choosing either to stand alone or to clasp hands with another person. Cured by Fire tells the story of two men whose lives are very different, but that converge when each man loses everything he holds dear. After their losses, they find themselves on separate journeys, leading from the tobacco fields of North Carolina to America's northwest coast. Reading from Cured by Fire, here's Tim McLaurin.
Lewis had never known such darkness and silence. He felt like the only living person on earth. Gradually, the dawn brightened until he was able to see the forest floor, thick with saplings and downed branches. Birds twittered. The cold seeped through his boots, and he wished for another pair of socks. The sun was still below the horizon, but now tree trunks were distinguishable. He swept his head from side to side to scan the spaces between trees and moved his feet up and down, wiggled his toes, trying to quicken the blood. One heel clunked against a board. The forest exploded with sound. The boy jerked his eyes toward the sound and saw the white tails of several deer crashing away in the undergrowth. "Jesus," Lewis sighed. The deer had been right underneath, and he had neither seen nor heard them. They were as silent as spirits. He pressed his feet against the boards and swore not to move again. 20 minutes passed. The sun began to blink through the boughs. Birds flitted from branch to branch, and a squirrel chattered at Lewis from a few yards away. First came the snap of a twig. He strained to listen. Then another twig broke. Lewis turned cautiously towards the noise. Another snap, and the head and neck of a buck jutted from behind a tree, a young five-pointer, his nose high to the wind, his ears jerked forward. He took another step and another until his whole body was visible between two trunks. The deer swung his head from side to side, then lowered it and nibbled at the ground. "Breathe," Lewis reminded himself. He pushed off the safety and raised the rifle to his shoulder, then moved the barrel inch by inch. When the crosshairs were trained on a spot just back of the deer's shoulder, he tightened his finger on the trigger. Then he stopped. The buck wasn't very large. The rack would be nothing to brag about. Next year he might be an eight-pointer. The realization slapped Lewis like a hand. Here he was in total control, the decision left only to him. He had always been under someone else's direction, following Carter's orders, complying with the social worker when his father got whiskey sick, bossed around by Mrs. Bullard and her sons. At school, he obeyed teachers' commands without question, and at home his father's, never asking why he did the things that forced him to leave. But on this bright dawn, in the cold boughs of this tree, the decision to shoot was totally up to him. A life in his own hands, Lewis lowered the rifle. "Bang," he shouted, "you're dead." The buck flinched, then wheeled and bounded deep into the woods. 2 weeks later, Lewis killed his first deer, an eight-point buck, with a clean shot through the heart.
Tim, welcome back to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on the publication of Cured by Fire.
Thank you, Wayne. It's a real pleasure to be here again.
Tell me what happens in this book.
Well, Cured by Fire is a novel about two men from very differing backgrounds who both face sudden catastrophe in their life, and they both have to deal with it with their own means. They come at the catastrophe with very different approaches. One sort of a rage against God and fate, the other trying to understand and accept.
All right. Now, we're talking here about Lewis Calhoun and Elbridge Snipes.
Right.
Did you know guys like this? I mean, how'd you invent these two characters? Tell me about that quickly.
Well, I do know people from sort of both sides of the novel. Certainly, Lewis is like many people who I live around today, middle class, successful, life sort of given to them on a platter. And then, like Elbridge, I worked in the tobacco fields myself as a kid and have known many people whose main livelihood came from the field and from the earth.
Right. Now, you say that both of these men, as you describe what happens to them in Cured by Fire, they lose it all. I will leave it to you to tell our listeners how much you want to reveal about what happens to each of these two guys. Can you summarize that quickly?
Mm-hmm. Well, each man, through fire, loses what he considers most dear, basically their families. And Lewis is burned on the exterior, mm-hmm. primarily his face. Elbridge is burned inside of his body in his lungs, and so they've lost basically everything they hold of value, and are left alone with their own faith or lack of faith,
uh-huh.
and how they set out to either continue their lives or end their life.
Now, part of the beauty of this book, Tim McLaurin, is the way you set up these two sort of contrasting scenes or two contrasting characters.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that you drew on your own experience in both instances, you know, sort of the comfortable middle class type and then the people, as you say, from the tobacco fields, the hard scrabble existence of Central North Carolina. Tell me, for example, about Lewis. We heard you read a passage here where Lewis is out hunting and he decides not to kill the deer. How does that go to what happens in your novel?
Mm-hmm. Lewis is raised hunting and fishing and enjoying the outdoors, and it's sort of his spiritual side. Some people go to church, some people hunt. And early in the novel, while Lewis is still a boy, he's in a tree for the first time hunting. His life has not been perfect. He has a father who is an alcoholic. At times, he's carried away to live with a foster parent, which is in itself pretty hard on him. In the tree, a deer approaches and stands beneath him, and he has the opportunity to kill the deer, but he decides in a sort of a blinding instant that here for the first time in his life, he has total control over a life. He is the one sort of godlike that holds domain, and so he decides not to kill the deer.
And this sets us up for this relationship that Lewis has later in the book with God, how should we put it, himself, herself, itself, the way he rages against the power up above him mm-hmm. when his life, his family, all that he holds dear has been taken away from him.
Right. Yes, Lewis sort of has an agreement with God in his own mind that I live a good, decent life, I pay my taxes, I don't break the law, and therefore I should have a decent life in return. And when everything is taken from him, it's sort of like going back to when he was a kid with the deer beneath him, he let the deer walk away. Mm-hmm. Well, Lewis feels like God picked him out and destroyed him or shot him, whatever, that he wasn't given the chance to continue his life and for no real reason. Therefore, his reaction is to basically, after the accident, to live to be a testimony to others of the cruelty of fate, of God, of the universe.
Well, now, when you say the accident, again, we don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but we're talking here about a moment of great loss in the life of this character.
Right.
At the same time, we have loss in the life of Elbridge Snipes. Now, I remember the last time you came to be on Soundings, you described what you were doing in Cured by Fire, and I said, hey, man, this sounds like the book of Job. Mm-hmm. We've got two different versions here, two different reactions to the way people handle loss. Let's talk about Elbridge for a moment. What's he all about?
Well, Elbridge is a real mixture of a human being. He was born in the hills of Kentucky. He's certainly of mixed blood. His mother was part Indian. His father was black. He's part Caucasian. He's a very small man with carrot red hair and blue eyes and brown skin.
Now, if I wanted to, I could accuse you of creating more stereotypes about Southern characters. How about this?
Well, I think in Southern characters, there are every type you can imagine exists. So here's one more strange one. But Elbridge has one thing that Lewis does not have when his own life is rent by catastrophe, and that is faith in God. He's after he leaves home at a tent meeting while he's working as a migrant worker, he is quote unquote saved and lives for God after that, carries his Bible around and tries to understand that all the events in his life, many of them that are not very pleasant or involve hard labor, are all for a purpose and a will that he just doesn't know exactly about.
In contrast to Lewis, who in one scene in your book almost makes the conversion, and then he stands up, goes to the head of the church, and mm-hmm. What happens to him?
Right. Lewis almost joins the church, partly through pressure from his wife, Beverly, and also that it makes good sense, good business sense. Lewis is a contractor, building contractor, and, you know, church has a lot of business people. And so he goes to the front, says he wants to join the church, is sent to a back room with another young woman where he's waiting to be baptized. And as he stands there, he's thinking about how he really doesn't feel anything. He says, you're supposed to feel something, and I don't. And through the window, he hears a mockingbird outside twittering. And the mockingbird is sort of symbolic that they mimic other birds, that they don't have their own true song. And Lewis realizes then that he is being a mockingbird. He's just mimicking other people for no real reason. So he turns and walks from the church and tells his wife he's not ready.
Now, both of these characters, Tim McLaurin, Elbridge and Lewis, have an opportunity to react to the bad fortune, the misfortune in their lives, blaming God, blaming other people, trying to figure out who's to blame for all this mess that we find ourselves in that we call mortality. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your own personal experience. What is it in your life that generated this kind of heat and tension that you put into this book?
Mm-hmm. Certainly my own life is tied to this novel, maybe in some ways more than my previous books. I remember, 6-7 years ago, being at a bank teller machine and standing behind a man who had been burned quite horribly. He had on a suit, but from his neck upward, you could see nothing but scars. He went to the machine, withdrew money. He turned around and looked at me and nodded, and I looked back at him and nodded and tried not to look somewhat horrified by the experience. And I remember thinking at that time that how it must be for someone to suddenly have something greatly affect your looks, your life, your family, whatever, but still be alive and have to continue and go forward through life, and how that must be very hard and must take a lot of courage. And then later in my own life, approximately 5 years ago, or actually 6 years ago, I was diagnosed with a rare form of bone marrow cancer called myeloma. Went through a transplant, which cured me of the disease, but there again, I was the person who was singled out sort of out of the blue. I was perfectly healthy all my life and suddenly had a death sentence put upon me. So that, you know, we don't go through life looking at the sky and waiting for a meteor to fall on us or something. But for certain people, that does happen. And it's how that person reacts and continues with their life or chooses not to continue.
Tim, let's invite you to read another passage from Cured by Fire. In a way, this is a passage that goes to the personal experience as well as the fictional experience that you've been describing. This is Elbridge Snipes, who has been taken to a mountainside by his friend Lewis. These two men, these two lives converge in the Northwest. Set this up for me briefly. What are we about to hear you read?
Well, the book is written in sort of a back and forth manner. The opening scene of the book is also the ending scene of the book. The two men have been through these sort of epic adventures and have met on the streets of Seattle, and finally they leave a hospital, Elbridge in pretty severe condition, Lewis taking him outside into the night air.
Now, he's suffering from this internal fire damage that you described earlier, this the misfortune in his own life.
Right. Elbridge is essentially dying from this, and Lewis takes him out to the mountainside to see the morning and to see a new day, hopefully. And so Elbridge is sort of having one of these out-of-body experiences that he keeps slipping in and out of himself throughout the book. And as I read, this is what is happening. Elbridge. I've floated out again. I'm like the ocean, surging forward, being sucked back in and out of myself. I hear this hum in the air like someone plucked a giant guitar string, and the noise is almost gone. Just a low hum, a nice sound, kind of like the wind and running water mixed together. I keep thinking I see shapes in the sky. I can't make them out, but there are forms that move and blend with the blackness beyond the stars. Lewis must be sleeping, his eyes closed, and his breath is regular. He's a big man. He'd make two of me. I don't believe I ever saw a man that was hurt so bad on the outside and still breathing. He's hurt even worse on the inside. I wish I could give him some of this peace I feel right now. I can't explain it, but it's like there's a word on the tip of my tongue, and that one word explains everything in the world and the whole sky. If I knew that word and could speak it to Lewis, maybe his wounds would heal. The word won't come to me, not yet, but something is coming. Each time I slip out of myself, the sky seems a little closer, and that hum I hear is a little louder, and now I see those shapes moving behind the moon and the stars. One thing I do know is that I've been wrong about a lot of stuff. For a while there, I got caught up in those words about being a temple. I like to think about myself as being something inside and not worry anymore about what anybody thought about me on the outside. I kept that temple locked up, but a temple has got to have doors or else it's no better than a prison. If you take those words about the temple too strong, that's what you'll become, shut up inside a prison, thinking all the time you're sitting inside a temple. And another thing I know is that it ain't no sin to put your arms around a person if they need it. The sin is if a person lifts their arms to you and you turn your back and walk away.
Tim McLaurin, we've just heard you read a passage here from Cured by Fire. This is an unusual book for you because it's the first one that's taken you out of your native state of North Carolina. Did that present any particular perils and rewards to you as a writer?
Well, it is interesting that this is the first book to have any scenes outside of the boundaries of North Carolina. But in my own life, I've done quite a bit of traveling. Even though I prefer to call North Carolina my home, I have lived in North Africa and I've traveled the entire United States and Europe. So I've certainly traveled. I thought maybe it was time to have some of these characters get out of the state a little bit. And also in this book, one of the themes that keep running throughout the pages is how people separate themselves from their past by walls, be the walls emotional, psychological, or physical. And particularly as Lewis journeys further and further from North Carolina, he keeps crossing these walls, like first the Blue Ridge Mountains, then the wide expanse of the Great Plains and the Rockies, and finally the Cascade Mountains, where he finally nestled inside of Seattle, begins to feel that he is insulated and far enough from his past that he doesn't feel anything anymore.
Let me present you with a paradox. Here you sit across this table from me, Tim McLaurin, the novelist. Here you're sort of waxing literary. My impression would be, though, that the first time I met you, I thought, you know, this is a tough guy. This is a guy who's been through the ropes. I mean, as you say, you were a Marine, you were in the Peace Corps, you went through this terrible experience with bone marrow cancer. You were a snake handler as a young person, a Pepsi salesman. Yet you are very much a literary type of person. Do you think of that as a contradiction in your life, Tim?
Well, most of the people that I have always admired that are literary people are also people who live very full, direct lives.
Real world types.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a certain impression of writers is as being people smoking pipes and you know, living a fantasy life is far from reality.
Well, whether it's literary or real experience, I can't let you get away without describing a couple of the, they're not exactly comic scenes in this book, Tim. I mean, this is not comedy. This is a very serious book.
Right.
But Reptile Man, now that in a way that goes to your own experience, and it's also important to what happens to one of your characters in this book. Mm-hmm. Lewis is the Reptile Man. What about that?
Right. After the accident, after Lewis is disfigured so badly, he falls into a real bout with alcohol where he's basically drinking himself to death, and he ends up as the character, the Reptile Man, in a traveling carnival. And, you know, myself in the past, I worked as a carnival snake handler, and I've seen how people react when they come in to look at snakes or to look at creatures that are disformed, disfigured. Snakes have, you know, certainly had a play in my own life. People listening can't see this finger, but this finger's a bit disfigured from last July. I was driving home at night, and there was a copperhead crossing the road, and I stopped and caught it. I didn't have a bag to put it in, so I continued driving home carrying the copperhead. Well, it twisted and bit my finger, and I spent two nights in the hospital, so I do know a little bit about snakes and disfigurement.
All right, now this is not exactly, I mean, it is not altogether a macho trip. You say you did this, you describe an incident in your own youth when you had an opportunity to either catch or walk away from a canebrake rattler.
Right.
And you did it because you were, what, battling a couple of twin demons here, fear and ignorance. We on the right track?
Right. For whatever reason, I was attracted to snakes. I'm never quite sure, but I do vividly remember confronting this poisonous snake for the first time. I had kept non-poisonous snakes in captivity. But here was, for one thing, snakes do represent overcoming ignorance. People have such a fear of reptiles basically because they don't have knowledge of reptiles. And if they were to learn, they would feel differently. I was always one to try to confront ignorance because, I didn't want to be afraid of something for no reason, and secondarily, I wanted to know the facts myself. I took my father and mother's advice, but I also wanted to look it up in a book, make sure that they were coming from the right angle also.
In a way, Tim, that summarizes your new novel, Cured by Fire. How do you want people to react to this book? It's pretty rough. It's pretty serious. Mm. We've got a couple of characters here who go through tests not only by fire, profound spiritual tests. Mm-hmm. What about it?
Yeah. Well, this is a serious book. It's not an airplane book by any means. And and I think it's a book that people, when they read, will question their own faith, sense of faith, of salvation. I mean, it's not a book about religion in the sense that it deals with established churches with Baptist or Catholic beliefs or whatever. It's just deals with spirituality and how each person determines their own sense of faith and salvation.
Can we find Tim McLaurin, the flesh and blood human being, in the pages of this book?
Certainly. As a kid, I was always caught between science and the church. I was given a telescope early on, and when I started learning astronomy and saw that the universe was incredibly vast and boundless, I began to question that religion was contained inside of a Southern Baptist church and that God lived there and you visited him on Sundays. And so I began to really open up my mind to a much more universal sense of what God, what religion consists of. So I'm certainly there in both characters. I am caught between Lewis and Elbridge, and that I place myself in each character and sort of battle out my own beliefs along the way.
Well, again, Tim, I don't want to let too much, we don't want to reveal too much and spoil this book for your readers and our listeners, but I think it is fair to say that even though it is very serious and it describes these terrible trials, it is finally an affirmative book. It does end on a note of faith. Mm-hmm. It's not syrupy by any means, but it is very positive. Is that, shall we put it crudely, the message of this new book?
Right. Wayne, it certainly is a belief of mine that there is a goodness behind what happens in the universe. I don't fully understand it, or I don't give it an official title, but I believe that goodness prevails throughout the universe. And at the end of this book, Lewis comes to a personal realization of who he is and who controls the universe. And it's maybe somewhat unorthodox or controversial, but I think the book says that each person, each man or woman, has to explore their own issues of faith and salvation.
Well, Tim, I congratulate you on this book. It is a wonderful novel. Let us tell our listeners about you and it. Tim McLaurin, you're the author of what, four novels now?
Three novels and one memoir.
And that would be Keeper of the Moon. This new book is called Cured by Fire. It's available from Putnam. Tim, what's on the horizon?
Well, I'm currently working on a new novel. I have another nonfiction book I want to write. I have quite a bit ahead. No writer's block. It's just making myself sit down and do it.
Well, Tim McLaurin, thank you so much for coming by the National Humanities Center to be on Soundings. I admire you and the books that you write, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thanks, Wayne. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tim McLaurin is the author of Cured by Fire, a new novel published by G.P. Putnam Sons. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Tim McLaurin's other books include Woodrow's Trumpet and Keeper of the Moon. Cassette tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 774. That's $10, program number 774. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about American nuclear policy and the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Japan. Joseph Gerson will be here to talk about his new book, With Hiroshima Eyes. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial funding for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. By Fire, the latest from novelist Tim McLaurin, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and a conversation with one of America's leading writers. In his new book, Tim McLaurin moves for the first time beyond his native North Carolina. He writes about two men who lose everything, but whose lives converge in unexpected rewards of the spirit. Cured by Fire, the latest from novelist Tim McLaurin, this week on Soundings.